Our latest guest on Soundtracking is John Crowley, the Irish film and theatre director who previously brought us critical successes Intermission, Boy A and Brooklyn, which I absolutely adored. His new offering is The Goldfinch, based on Donna Tartt's novel of the same name. The narrative centres on Theo, a young man who takes a painting from a museum after his mother dies in a terrorist attack. Now, whilst the cinematography is provided by undisputed master of the art, Roger Deakins, John went for a relative novice in Trevor Gorakis for the score. And it's with Trevor's cue, Goldfinch Reveal, that we begin. Oh, John, it's a real pleasure to have you on Soundtracking.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having
so
me.
So much to talk about. But let's start with The Goldfinch. And music plays a part in this film narratively as well as for the purpose of creativity. I love the tone that you set with the film, with the score. But let's talk about music and this story, first of all. Was it easy to find how it would sound for you?
No. No, it was extremely difficult. And I decided on a composer very, very late in the day. And that's because the tone of the piece is so particular and tricky to land. And it's got such an odd mix of elements.
Yeah.
That, you know, I mean, I'm not a big fan of using temp scores anyway. I find it very difficult. And of course, then you know, I'm sure you're very aware of that, but you can get stuck in sort of temp love, you know, that you can often hear the DNA of a temp score coming through the actual score of a film. And I really didn't want that in this instance. I had a brilliant music editor who sort of would try lots of different colors on the film as we were editing it and really began to get a foothold in it, and kept returning to this idea that it had to feel yearning, you know,
it was
an emotion that it had to feel like there was an emotional reach from Theo to in the middle of this stuck place that he finds himself.
And those different locations as well.
Absolutely.
Very much have their own sound.
Identity.
Yeah,
yes,
definitely.
They did. And you know, the whole Vegas section there had a very different sort of palette to it. Every time you put something wrong in the film would sort of effortlessly shrug it off, as it were. It would go, no, not right.
But it
wouldn't actually talk to me and tell me what was right. So we had to keep going at it.
Try harder, John,
exactly.
Is what it's telling
you. Try harder. So, you know, a lot of that Vegas section has a lot more of a sort of almost a more ambient, abstract electronic texture quality to it, which isn't just about the space there. It's just much more about the emotional state that he finds himself in.
Thank you.
And then, of course, it had to have a sort of propulsive quality at times as well, as certainly as we move into Amsterdam at the end, where there's that breathless quality of him being way out of his depth.
Interesting you say that, because there was some sort of just seeing it this morning and kind of, you know, trying to reread my bad writing and my notes and stuff, there was things that I really pinpointed on where there were moments where I felt there was this beautiful use of almost like multiple melodies over each other that almost felt like you were getting a reflection of his emotions being in turmoil internally, sort of thing. And I thought that was just beautifully conveyed through Trevor's score, really.
Yeah, he also, you know, what Trevor did was he went away and wrote 10 minutes of music for the for the film as an audition, as it were, because he was introduced to me by Sue Jacobs, our fantastic music supervisor. And having left it very late in the day to make a decision on this, you know, I was nervous of using somebody who hadn't a great deal of experience.
Yeah.
But she had pegged him as a young assistant in Philip Glass's studio years ago.
Well, she's coming from good stock.
Totally.
Yeah.
And so I met him, and he's very quiet. So he doesn't talk a good movie. He doesn't need to talk a good movie because he scores a good movie, as it were. So but he went away, and I was so blown away by what he came back with.
Yeah.
And he immediately had the repeating figure in there, which just, without over explaining it, felt like something trapped and felt like something which wasn't resolving itself in the music and had attention to it.
Yeah.
And something which wanted to take flight and couldn't. And that sort of, in a weird way, gave us the whole score, because I knew how to handle the mother sequence at the end without it being sentimental, and that it would answer itself musically by resolving itself.
And did you send him edits and cuts of things to watch in terms of to come up with something? Was that the...
He watched the whole film.
The whole film. Great.
Without any music on it.
Wow.
So he responded completely coldly, should we say, you know?
To the performances though as well, I think.
To performances. And he hadn't read the book.
Yeah.
So he came to it and he was very drawn into it. It suddenly, I could tell that he just got it and suddenly became obsessed with this young boy's dilemma and his attachment to this object and what it meant and how to express that and in musical terms, which is what we had been working very hard to try and express in visual terms and in performance terms, you know. And he was very special.
Yeah. It's interesting because when we speak to directors and composers about, you know, at what point they come on board with projects, it's all very different for each project. But Barry Jenkins and Nicholas Britell are ones who spring to mind, who Nicholas doesn't come on until he's shot the film because he wants Nicholas to react to the performances.
Yeah.
So, you know, if Beale Street Could Talk, if it hadn't been Regina playing that role, Nicholas's music would have been completely different because of that performance, which is really interesting too.
You see, I love that. I find that music is the most difficult thing to talk about at any point, right? But especially early on in the process.
Yeah.
I mean, we were halfway through editing this film before I met Trevor, you know, and it was pretty formed as an edit. I knew what it was at that point. But I'm always fascinated by directors who can actually compose music before the shooting and actually, you know, shoot the film
to the
score.
Basis,
it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing to me. I would never even begin to know how to do that.
There's a couple of other bits as well that I wanted just to pull up, which I thought were amazing. Was obviously Glenn Gould's a character in the story in terms of where he, you know, how his world features in one of the characters' world as well. So you kind of have to have that in there, don't you? Mm-hmm. So, but the way that it's played out is just, it's really subtle and beautiful. Piece actually right at the end where he's kind of laying out the pills and it's so emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Really kind of, it's almost like it's kind of playing with your heart in a little way. It's so clever, but so subtle as well.
Yeah, and it's a circular piece and it goes round and round and round, and it feels like somebody who's going, you know, I've reached the end of this and I have no more to say other than this. And it is very, very... you're right, because of course the target of that scene, no spoilers, is the most emotional shot in the whole film, and so that took a long time to circle it, no pun intended. We kept coming back to it, and he kept working it, and I think it's my favorite piece in the whole film.
Thank you. the contemporary tracks that you've used as well are brilliant. When I New Order, Your Silent Face, for kind of when we meet Boris, really, or when he meets Boris kind of for the first time.
Thought that never changes remains a stupid lie. It's never been quite the same. No hearing or breathing, no movement, no colour, just silence. The rise and fall of shame. Search that shall remain. We asked you what you'd seen. You said you didn't care.
And then that Radiohead track, Everything in Its Right Place. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the first sound of that piece of music kind of, it's almost like it scoops up my insides anyway, so.
I know, and it's a track I adore, and I thought long and hard whether it was the right gesture, because it's quite a well-known track, to put it mildly.
Oh, you know, great.
So I was a bit worried, okay, is that going to be okay, or is it going to take you out of the film? But ultimately, we tried so many other tracks there and kept coming back to that track that there was no way of beating it.
Is it your kind of like connection with the story that you're pulling on bands or things that you like to kind of
Radiohead is mentioned in the book,
yeah.
You know, different tracks,
yeah.
But tonally, I mean, I worship their work, so I didn't need much convincing.
Yeah,
it's Karma Police is the one that's referred to in the book,
yeah.
Quite a lot, you know. Codex is one which it's a track that I adore,
yeah.
And there's a lyrical connection with the sequence that you're looking at of jumping into the water, but that's not quite what was important to me. That was the very first piece of music we put on the film in the edit, actually, because
yeah.
Kelly, our editor, had tried out a few different tracks for the editor's assembly, and they didn't quite sit in there with what I was looking for tonally.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, can we just try this? Because this is actually what's always been in my head, Codex, at this point. And
yeah.
We tried it, and it sat with the images beautifully, and it just wound up staying there all the way through
yeah.
the entire edit. It never left. Place was, you know, a little bit later into the edit as we were trying, because we tried a lot of different, some more psychedelic, trippy music there, and tried to find something a little bit more off the beaten track, she would say, but mm-hmm. kept coming back to Radiohead.
It's talking to you again.
Know? It is talking to you. The film does talk to you.
Yeah.
It's true. And you know, then there's the Dylan track, of course,
yeah,
which is mentioned in the book, and it's mentioned in a scene which is in the film, where Mrs. Barber comes up to the door and closes the door, and the two boys playing chess. There's a cocktail party going on, and Theo has a memory of hearing the pianist at the party playing "It's All Over Now, Baby Blue." And that always stuck with me all the way along. And of course, you know, it's an amazing track. I love the track.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. He understands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
So we tried out every version we could get our hands on of It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, of cover versions to see is there one that would allow us a way in.
Yeah.
You know, Marianne Faithfull has got a great one, and you know, but the second we heard the opening of that Van Morrison and them, that was it.
Yeah.
It
was, you know, can't replicate that.
Yeah.
You think will last, but whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. Yonder stands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Baby, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
What was your connection with this story, and why did you want to make the film of the Goldfinch?
I loved the book, and I had read it for pleasure shortly after it came out when I was making Brooklyn, and it struck me as a profoundly original meditation, for want of a better word, on grief. And there's an idea sort of running through the veins of the book that I found very touching, which is the idea that a beautiful work of art, experiencing it isn't a passive consumer experience, that actually a great painting or a great poem or film or play contains within itself a challenge that if you respond to it and you love it, that you spot what's of lasting value in it and look after it, in a sense that it almost demands it of you. That and so going to see this painting long before we shot the film as well, the way that the bird looks at you and you look back at it, it's quite striking. And I can see absolutely why this work of art would obsess Donna enough to base the whole story around it. So they were the big emotional reasons for me that felt very powerful.
And then when you make that decision, you're going to, what with this particular adaptation, was the script written and then you came on board, or at what point? And
the first draft, Peter had, when Warner's had a first draft, they asked me if I'd like to read it, and they were sending it to, you know, a bunch of their sort of selected directors, as it were. So from that point on, I was auditioning for it, really, basically, and very happy to be auditioned, as it were. And kept failing upwards till they gave me the job. So
I think it's a brilliant marriage, because you can feel the heart in it, you can feel the connection in it, I think, as well. And I think that, I was really interested in terms of from that first draft that you read, how involved you get in then what you end up shooting, you know, in terms of rewrites and how you mold it into your vision, as well as, you know, what Peter's written as well.
Sure. Both of us really focused in on the idea of grief, basically, and on the idea of this kid being stuck in his grief and how to tell that story visually, you know. So the whole idea of that unfolding. I mean, in the novel, you get to meet his mother and you spend quite a lot of time with her at the very start of the book. And one of the challenges here was, okay, if we don't do that, if we hold a more visual idea, which is, you know, no, spoiler alert, but you don't see the mom until the very, very end.
Yeah.
Can we sustain that idea? And it did give us a certain visual approach, which was very helpful editorially as well, which is letting go of this great big sort of Dickensian buildings romance type structure that Donna has of coursing through a whole boy's life up into his adult years and focusing in on two time periods meant that we were able to suggest the way that the past sits on the shoulders of the present all the time.
Yeah.
And you're able to get a little bit more access to his internal world visually. And I was very mindful or sort of struck by a phrase, this sort of phrase was kind of haunting me when I was making the film, which is a phrase that Nicholas Roeg used many years ago, saying, you know, in the editing room, all time is available all the time. And I just love that idea of being able to move backwards and forth as fluidly and as elegantly as possible to express an emotional state rather than just rendering the story. So to answer your question, that there were numerous drafts done, not vastly different. We kept distilling down, kept focusing in on, and you'd take wrong steps occasionally, you know, and we would keep going back to the book and keep challenging what was written there and seeing is there a better way that we can clear away, more lucid way that we could express it visually. And right up to shooting, Peter was, you know, he would rewrite scenes as we were doing it. So it was, there was a lot of rewriting that got done.
And then working with Roger Deakins as well.
Amazing.
I mean, those kind of, the way that he, like, kind of just the sensual way that he brings things to life, be it, you know, when you're in the desert with them in the Vegas sort of area, or in the remnants of that museum after the blast, or even in the antique shop, you can smell the wood, you can, you know, you can almost see your reflection in it sort of thing. So amazing.
Beautiful, yeah.
So good. I mean, stunning work. What's he like to work with?
Well, the amazing thing for me with Roger, I mean, he's a man of few words, and as somebody said, he doesn't need to have many words because he's one of the best visual artists on the planet. He's delightful, but he's all about character and story, which is fascinating to me. Is because he creates some of the most beautiful and indelible images in the last 40 years in cinema, but it's all, he just wants to know what's going on with the character. So we would have these huge long conversations. I've never talked through a script in as much detail psychologically with a collaborator as I did on this. We would keep going back to the script, reading them together, talking about what it was, what it is, what's going on underneath the surface of the scenes. So the image comes last, at the very, very end of the process for him. And I think that's why, despite the stunning nature of so many images, he never creates an image which screams, look at me.
Yeah.
It's always saying, look at this, or look at this, or feel this, or, you know.
Footstep going through the rubble. Do you know all that? Simple
I know. Very, very simple. Yeah. Very simple. And, you know, the whole conversation about how to approach the Met was a critical one, because I was very nervous that the scale of the event, that explosion, would in some sense, that it would almost capsize the film, that you couldn't come back from an event of that scale when actually what the film was going after emotionally was something very internal and small and delicate. And I didn't want the melodrama of that awful event to overshadow the whole thing. So the whole idea of doing it completely from his point of view, completely through memory and in shards, and taking away the more no pun intended, explosive or louder aspects of that event, and doing it much more impressionistically, felt like the right approach. And then also not seeing architecture in the post explosion part, that it's almost in this kind of gray miasma, so that you have these sort of ghostly figures,
even the doorways, you'd have no idea where it's going.
Clever. So that was a very important decision that we both arrived at early on in prep, as a way, because the art department kept asking us, how much are we seeing, how much of this wall is blown down, and it just always would come back to, unfortunately, referencing real life horrific events, which felt, I didn't want to reference them in this instance. I didn't feel it was appropriate or tasteful.
Before we run out of time, can we talk about two of your other brilliant films, if that's all right? Brooklyn and Boy are just two that I picked out, if that's all right. I mean, Brooklyn, I mean, where do you start? I feel kind of slightly like I'm not giving you your dues by not dedicating an entire episode of this to Brooklyn, but maybe we can have a second sit-in. But with that, and working with Michael Brook on that that film, and that film warranting specific things because of location and time period and navigating that around the score as well. Mm. Was that an easy thing to work on, or how did you arrive at Brooklyn and how it would sound?
They were in lots of ways very opposite journeys. In lots of ways, the two films would kind of complement each other in a weird way.
Yeah.
You know, and the difficulty production wise with Brooklyn, of course, was trying to mount a story, a period story, on what was actually a very, very tight budget. And, you know, we got 2 days in New York. So
2 days?
Yeah, yeah. So the rest of it was shot in Montreal. So, you know, you were trying to hide or throw away the background. So in a way, I kind of made a decision early on, okay, I'm going to make this film about a face and about Saoirse. So that gave me a very particular way in. This is different. This was one where you've got a kid who's moving through completely different environments, and it needs a wide frame at times. And, and his relationship to his environments in each case is expressing the image, the emotion that he can or can't reveal to anybody else. He's isolated and trapped within everything. So they were kind of opposite ends of the visual sphere. And then consequently, you know, the task for the score was very different. I mean, the emotion in Brooklyn was scoring what was going on straight in the heart, the heartbreak in Eilish and in Saoirse's amazing performance.
Yeah.
And so we were responding moment by moment to that.
Yeah.
Trying to express that and capture that and liberate that on a screen. There's a bit more of a frame around Theo's experience in this film.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more, even though it's impressionistic at times, and even though it's point of view, you are aware of the world that he's trapped in a little bit more. So that took a different tone in this instance.
We've run out of time, but please can we have sitting number two where we can go into that?
Delighted to
talk about working with Paddy as well, and on Boye as well.
I've just worked with on a play that we just opened the play 3 weeks ago, called The Very Expensive Poison at the Old Vic. He did the music for that.
Oh, wow, amazing. But listen, congratulations on The Goldfinch. I really enjoyed it, and I'm going back to dive into the original material.
Thank you very
much,
Edith. Thanks. Such a pleasure.
You too. From the Score to Brooklyn by Michael Brook. That's the opening titles, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with John Crowley. My huge thanks to John for taking the time to talk to us. Such a treat to get to sit down with him. The Goldfinch is on general release now, with Trevor's score available via our good friends at Water Tower Music. Now, we'll put a Spotify playlist for this show via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to catch up with all of our previous episodes and subscribe to the podcast. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do also check out our YouTube channel for content that doesn't quite fit into the podcast. Next up, very excited to bring you a female double bill. First up, actress, writer and director Dolly Wells, talking about her feature film debut, Good Posture. As well as Dolly, very excited to bring you composer Hilda Gunnatottir, who'll be talking amongst other things about her work on The Joker. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.